We'll call to order the Conference Committee on House File 2777. First, we don't have a side-by-side, but what you have in your packet is the House File 2777 as passed by the House, and the unofficial engrossment is the language from the Senate. Members, I thought I would have staff go through the differences between the House and the Senate language, then take questions and testimony. Staff, does someone just want to quick go through the difference? Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's only one difference, and it's found in the last paragraph on page 2, paragraph G, starting on the Senate side. The Senate added an extra sentence to paragraph G, and you can see it starts on 230 of the unofficial engrossment. And it basically gives the source individual a chance to go before the court on a hearing if they're brought in to collect a sample after the court has ordered them in an ex parte hearing to do so, or otherwise, really. So it gives a second chance for them to almost relitigate the matter.
All right, questions from members? For Representative Champion? Nope. Okay. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on either of these provisions?
So,
Senator Champion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So are we going to get testimony? I think I heard you say from maybe an agency or someone that would be subjected to this bill?
We certainly can ask. Is there anyone who could come up to the table and answer some questions?
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Dennis Flaherty, and I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. And I was around when this bill, in fact, involved in the passage of the original protocol and procedures surrounding this legislation. So I am quite familiar with it, and I'd be glad to answer questions that you might have.
Mr. Flaherty, can you tell me how frequently have you seen this used at all?
Fortunately, very seldom. Not that significant exposures do not take place, because they do. And they involve all of our emergency workers, paramedics and fire and police, both paid and volunteers that serve throughout our state. But typically what happens when it has been determined that there is a significant exposure, and by determined I mean by an infectious disease physician, the source individual will be asked to submit a sample of blood. And thankfully, most often they will do that. And that will immediately help rule out the possibility that the emergency worker has been infected with, say, HIV or hepatitis B or C. And it prevents a lot of psychological suffering for the emergency worker and the pain of starting a medical treatment program involving injections of various drugs that can take place over a period of several weeks or even months. But we have had situations that brought rise to this bill where, despite being asked by emergency room personnel, other health specialists, for a source individual to voluntarily submit blood, the person has, for many reasons, most of which is out of spite, they have refused to give a sample of blood for testing purposes.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. And so that's what, and a judge, and the statutes lay out the procedure that when there's continued refusals, but the matter can be brought before a judge. But unfortunately, the law in, I think, 2000 did not envision people not coming to court where a judge could order blood to be taken. And so now this bill would allow for an ex parte hearing, and where the judge, if they determine to do so, could order that the individual be taken into custody and for the purposes of taking blood and for that purpose only.
Representative, or Senator Champion. Sorry.
You know, I tell people, Madam Chair, that I'm a good senator because I was House trained, so it's okay.
Get up, Doug. Let me get
a
chair.
Okay, all right.
Senator Champion.
I do have several questions. So, Mr. Flaherty, I'm looking at Subdivision 2A. It says an emergency medical services agency, or if there's no agency, an emergency medical services person. So would that include a police officer and or a Good Samaritan?
Mr. Flaherty.
Okay, and 2A.
And we certainly can ask staff as well. This is current law under the section. So
could I just ask where you're referencing it one more time?
Senator Champion.
Line 1.9 and line 1.10.
Mr. Flaherty, if you'd like staff to answer, we certainly can have them do that. Mr. Flaherty.
Well, Madam Chair, to me what that means is there are agencies that for emergency personnel that have EMS directors, that in other words, physicians that work with fire departments, police departments, medic services, but then there are some that don't, and they would probably rely on their emergency, whatever emergency room they typically most often use.
Senator Champion.
Yeah, so maybe staff can help with this question because the way the testifier is articulating it, it could be very narrow, right? It's my understanding that this could be a person who is providing emergency services to someone even out in the public where, let's say, someone was having a some sort of attack or something and hit their head and their head was bleeding. And so maybe we can ask a staff if this is only narrowly tailored to emergency medical service agencies, or if there's no agency, what does it mean when it says an emergency medical services person?
Mr. Deagle.
Madam Chair, Senator Champion, the definition of emergency medical services person in Section 144.7401 provides that it covers licensed peace officers as well as Good Samaritans who render emergency care or assistance at the scene of an emergency or while an injured person is being transported to receive medical care.
All right.
Senator Champion.
Thank you. And a follow-up, and maybe staff can help. So if this is if this also includes a Good Samaritan person, so can you give me a practical example where a person will ask the source individual if they can have a sample of their blood?
Mr.
Dale,
this is in hypotheticals. Mr. Flaherty, do you have any suggestions on how a sample?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator, the person would go into an emergency receiving hospital, and that's where an infectious disease doctor would have to determine that, number one, there has been a significant exposure, and whether it's to a peace officer or a Good Samaritan, it's all going to be handled the same way. And they're going to immediately begin by locating the source individual and asking them to voluntarily submit for testing purposes and provide a blood sample.
So, Madam Chair, so Mr.
Senator
Flaherty,
Champion.
And so who would locate the source individual and ask them that question? Because I naturally assume there already has to be a determination by a physician or someone qualified that there's been substantial exposure or significant exposure in order for that process to even take place. So who then would make the contact with the source individual and ask them to provide a sample?
Mr. Flaherty.
Madam Chair, typically the emergency personnel of the hospital, wherever they've determined that the person has a significant exposure. There's protocols that this bill involves, or this law, I should say, involves protocol being established in every emergency receiving room in the state of Minnesota. That goes way back to the first enactment of this law. And so whether you're in the metro area or whether you're outstate Minnesota, there are protocols in place anytime someone is identified or diagnosed, better put, with a significant exposure. And so those protocols would immediately begin by contacting the source individual.
Also, Representative Johnson has a comment as well.
Yeah, I don't mind that.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Chamberlain, a good example is one that happened to me. Back in 1992, we got called to a situation as a peace officer. It was a gentleman that was out of control. It was a medical situation because he was overdosed on PCP. It was a very tense situation. The gentleman was running around. Had cut himself numerous times. But what made it more challenging, he had absolutely no clothes on. I ended up getting a very large exposure to his blood all over me. And that was before this law was in effect back in 92. And after it was done, we got him in the ambulance. We requested a sample for that to find out if he had any infectious diseases. He refused. I spent years wondering what was going on, doing testing, continuous testing. And it was about 3 or 4 years for the final test before I got the all clear. But what makes this even, with these people refuse, what makes it even more challenging, especially with our emergency medical personnel, our ambulance drivers, our paramedics, they're dealing with individuals all the time. If they don't find out this information, they are scared to do their job because they don't want to pass something along. So something like this needs to be taken care of.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. But I think, Representative Johnson, I think the examples that you all are giving seem to be limited to emergency individuals, but this bill goes a little, it goes beyond that. Because when you think in terms of even the definition of a emergency medical services person, that could also include a good Samaritan. And then when you start thinking in terms of other people who now come into the web of possibility, the practical questions that I'm asking Mr. Flaherty then becomes much more important. Like, for an example, if a person believes that there was significant exposure, they then would have to deal with a physician who then has to determine that there was significant exposure. Then now you got to practically ask the person, you know, for a sample. If you're on the street and the person decides or refuses medical treatment, then what do we do in a situation like that? So we know, and I know I was talking to the chair and we talked about law enforcement and others. Well, maybe I'll get to this question then. So the individual, Mr. Johnson, who was significantly or who significantly exposed you, could they, under this law, request for you to give a blood sample in the event that they felt like they need to check your blood?
Yes.
Mr. Flaherty.
Madam Chair and Senator, so you're asking if a peace officer, let's just say a cop was involved, and they provided a significant exposure, an officer would certainly submit to voluntary testing, rather than subject any person to what they would be subjected to. I think any emergency worker would submit.
So, Madam Chair, But where is that in the bill, Mr. Flaherty? You're telling us what you think a police officer would do. A police officer, I'm sure, would do the right thing, but they still would have the option to say no. And if so, show me in the bill where a person can say, hey, I've been significantly exposed, so let me ask the police officer or that EMT officer for a blood sample. Tell me what happens in that situation in the event that someone said no.
Madam Chair, if a citizen had received a significant exposure as determined by an infectious disease physician, and if the source individual were a peace officer or were a paramedic, they would certainly be asked. If they were the source individual, they would be asked to submit a sample of their blood.
And what if they refuse?
The same protocols that are in place by law would be applied to them.
Well,
Mr. Representative Neuberger also has a question. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Champion, you bring up a valid question. I speak with authority on this issue. I am a paramedic. I have been full-time at a level one trauma center for 28 years. I've lost count of the number of exposures I've had to different pathogens, bloodborne or otherwise. I will tell you this, if we're in the field, if I show up on a car accident or a shooting or whatever, and there is a significant blood exposure, let's say you got there 10 minutes before me and you decided that you were going to help this individual, and by the time I got there, you were up to your elbows in blood. What I would do as a professional, I would, part of treating this scene, because you want to make sure that you take care of the whole scene, is I would approach you and I would say, sir, you have what appears to be a significant exposure. First thing I would do is I would give you something to clean yourself with. And then the next thing that I would do and have done and will continue to do is I would say, sir, I highly recommend that you go to the emergency room, follow us in, just get in your car, or we will take you if you want to go with us, if you don't have transportation, and to come in, and we will put you in front of the people that can walk you through the process if you believe, if you're concerned about a significant pathogen exposure. That's what we would do. And if you said no, then you would fully have that right to say, you know what, I'm okay because, you know, that person that was hurt, she looks like she's a 80-year-old grandma and she probably had clean living and I'm not worried about it. Or you could look at that person and say, you know, I've got reservations about that person. I think that person might be a risk and I've just been exposed to that person's blood. We would certainly offer to you the information and say, look, you should have this. Don't let this go and at least start the process. I have done that multiple times over the years. That's just part of how that works. It would be up to you as an individual who has been exposed. Then it's your decision whether or not you're going to go in and get checked.
Madam Chair, thank you, and thank you for that as well. This is not the question whether you at the scene would ask someone a question as to whether they believe there was significant exposure or not, and if they want to be examined, right? It's the practical aspects of things that I'm concerned about. Even for a Good Samaritan, let's say a person who's been treated by you at the scene, there's been significant exposure, and maybe you didn't think there were significant exposure, but maybe that person did, and they went to a doctor, and the doctor says, yeah, there was significant exposure, right? So tell me, where would it require, could that person ask under this law for a blood sample from you? And maybe we should ask counsel that, because I don't think that this law allows for that to happen. Now, they can ask you, but if you said no, I'm not sure that they can use this law by which to now come and require a blood sample of you. And maybe that's a question for counsel. Maybe counsel can help you.
Hopefully I can answer this quickly for Senator Champion. The situation that you portray would have to pertain to both of us being injured. Because if you're talking about a significant exposure, if you were injured, right, and let's say you had an arterial bleed, your brachial artery, whatever, and in the course of helping you, we got blood everywhere, and your concern was, hey, you know, that paramedic should be, if I got to be checked, well, why not the paramedic? Well, that's a fair question. The question would be is was that paramedic bleeding? Did any blood leave my body? Because if I was also injured and my blood got on you and your blood got on me, then yeah, absolutely, this law would completely apply. But if I'm standing there and I don't have a scratch on me, then that wouldn't be the case.
Fourth source, I get that, yeah.
Let me just get some clarification. So then if you're both bleeding, then you both would be defined as source individuals under the statute.
Potentially, yes. Thank you.
Senator Chambers.
Well, maybe we should ask counsel, because I think that your interpretation seems to me to not apply, because the individuals who are able to request for a blood sample under this provision would be an emergency medical service agency or an emergency medical services person who's providing this service, as opposed to the person who's on the receiving end of the service. And so even if there was an exchange of blood, the person who, I think you get the gist of my question.
Mr. Deeble.
Madam Chair, Senator Chapman, I would agree that the statute is focused on providing treatment to first responders, whether they be a Good Samaritan, peace officer. But I think what you're asking is for a different bill. This statute's been on the books for many years, and you're asking for it to do something that it doesn't do now, and that's not in the conference committee. So I would say that the question before the conference committee is solely whether this extra hearing should be granted, as opposed to another bill or an amendment to the statute that would allow these people to petition for a non-consensual blood draw. And I would add, though, that for a first responder to be eligible to exercise their rights under the statute, they have to consent to a blood draw. For the expert to identify them as someone who might be eligible, they would have to go through a blood draw, and that would be one of the steps that needs to be taken before they can exercise their rights under forcing a source individual to.
Madam Chair?
Senator Champion.
All right. So with that being said, then I have some other questions about the bill itself. So. It's my understanding, based on the new section that we are looking at, is whether an ex parte hearing can be held by the judge. And that happens after there's been proper service.
That's correct, Senator Champion. And the language in the House and the Senate are identical on that provision.
Gotcha. And so proper service does not mean personal service. Would you agree with that, Madam Chair?
Let's ask that. Proper service, Mr. Deeble, under the current law is...
Could include blood. But not limited to personal service.
Madam Chair, that's my understanding, is that it would be legal service. So it could be by, if you can't find the person, then you could do it by notice.
And notice, you
Senator
mean?
Senator Champion. Mr. Deeble.
Publication in a, I forgot the exact words that the statute used, but it's a basically legal publication that is...
So,
Senator Champion, and that's current law.
Yes. So I'm just trying to make sense of this. Even if it's current law, I think that this, you know, bill is asking for something that's really substantial. And I'm sure that Madam Chair is not suggesting that it's not asking for something really huge here, which is, if I might, if a person who may, a veteran, I'll use a veteran as an example. Let's say a veteran is identified as someone who is a source individual. A person, a Good Samaritan, could potentially go to a doctor, and the doctor would have to say that there was significant exposure. There would have to be a petition and a filed, and then I guess the question is also whether there would have to be a cost, but that's another question. there would be a petition filed, and then they have to be serviced. So let's say the veteran is experiencing post-traumatic syndrome and is away at a mental health hospital, but service is provided to the at the person's last known address.
Could be left with a wife or someone else or a child over the age of 18, but it's left there.
Now, it's my understanding that that veteran, who may not even know about it because no one told the veteran about it, now this bill would allow a hearing to occur, ex parte, judge is able to say there is a significant finding that we should, you know, that I should render this order, and now the police can be dispatched to now locate this person and grab them, for lack of a better way of putting it, and now force them to go provide a blood sample.
Senator Champion.
Is that right?
Senator Champion, on line 2.16 to 2.17 of current law, which is listed in the bill, the court will consider whether or not involuntary blood collection and testing would serve the public interest. So the court would determine whether or not involuntary blood would be permitted to be taken.
And under my scenario, now that veteran, if the court determines that involuntary blood collection would serve the public interest, there could be an order for that veteran to provide that blood sample. So upon finding that person, so once the court dispatches or someone dispatches a peace officer for the purpose of obtaining a blood sample, that person would now have to give that blood sample involuntarily, which means by force. Is that right or is not right, counsel?
Senator Champion, again, on line 2.16, which is current law, the court would be the one that would make that determination of whether or not that sample could be taken involuntarily. The court doesn't have to order it. The court may order it, but it is for the court to determine as they go through and make their findings about whether or not there is a compelling need for test results. And so that is current law. That's currently the standard, and the court would take everything that they had into account before making that determination. So,
Madam Chair.
Senator Champion, on line 2.21 to 2.23, it permits the court to conduct that ex parte hearing if the source individual does not attend. However, Senator Champion, when whoever goes to pick up the source individual, they still can ask the person, are you willing to give the sample? And the person at that point can voluntarily give it or not. If they still say no, the court will have already determined whether or not a sample can be taken involuntarily.
And when you say involuntarily, because I was asking counsel, but you seem to be answering full counsel, which is okay, how then will that sample be taken if the person says no?
Well, currently under Minnesota law, there are methods by which folks take involuntary samples, for example, in a search warrant. And I would assume that those protocols
instance.
Are the same. This is current law. This is exactly the same as current law is done. I'm not asking to change that. This bill only says whether or not you can have the hearing. And I would bet the judge certainly can make that determination when the judge considers whether the involuntary blood collection is permitted or not.
So, Madam Chair, I noticed that you still are not answering the question. So based on the scenario that I'm giving, if a peace officer goes out and the person says, no, I'm not willing to give a blood sample because I don't know anything about this. I never knew of any hearing. What happens if the person says no? When we say involuntary, will that mean they take it by force?
They certainly could, Senator Champion, if the court permitted it, but only within the guidelines under which the court permitted.
And so the person never had an opportunity to be heard because they were not at court, and based on my scenario, if they were not around, that would technically be notice and proper service, even though the person had no knowledge of the hearing itself.
Senator Champion, usually when folks are serving, in many instances, if they know where the person is or the person's in treatment, they certainly give that information.
You're so, speculating now.
So are you, Senator Champion, with all due respect here. Senator Champion, the question is, there is one sentence difference between the House and the Senate bill. We have all of the rest of the language is the same. And so the question is, what should we do about the amendment that you added to the bill? And I haven't heard you advocating yet on why the House should accept your provision. So line 2.30 to line 2.32, that is the difference. I'd really like to hear you advocate for why the House should take the Senate position.
So I'm definitely going to advocate for that, but I thought whenever you come to a conference committee hearing that you can at least do an analysis so that you can get to that particular place of space. But it appears to me that that's not what you like to do, Madam Chair. And so because you
Senator
are the one who
would
hit the gavel.
Senator Champion, we're debating current law and we're not making changes to any of the areas that you've been talking about so far. I get that you're laying the framework and we've been allowing you to have some room. But now, Senator Champion, I think it's time that we talk about the differences in the bill.
And so we would definitely do that. But you understand as well as I do, because you're a lawyer and so am I, is that current law, and if you're looking at a change, there's always an impact on current law based on what you are putting forward. And from your perspective, what we put forward is this. You already had in your bill a line that says a person may not be held for more than 24 hours without receiving a court hearing, which is, we started at line 2.29. We thought it would be important for there to be some clarification, because the way that was structured is that if a person, in my scenario, for an example, that veteran who did not have knowledge or notice of the hearing gets stopped or arrested, they are now asked to go. They're asked to give the sample. They say, "No, I don't even know anything about it." They could be held in jail for up to 24 hours. Is what you had before. They could be held in jail for up to 24 hours, and then there would have to be a court hearing. We just wanted to clarify that says if there was a refusal, that particular person then would stay and have to go to go before a judge and articulate why they feel like they should not have to provide that sample, namely saying, "I was not served. I didn't know anything about it. I did not have an opportunity to be heard. So I know nothing about it," whether it's by publication, whether it's by any other form of service. So from my vantage point, I think it makes sense when you think in terms of detaining someone, because that's what you're looking at doing, was detaining someone. And whenever you look at taking someone's personal liberty of detaining them without an opportunity for them to be heard, then from the Senate's perspective, we believe that they should have an opportunity to be heard.
Well, Senator Champion, the only challenge is adding that language actually negates the court's ability to order this involuntary blood collection, because what you've said is it doesn't matter what the court ordered on the involuntary blood collection. If they say no, you got to bring them back to court within 24 hours. And so you're actually undoing current law, which already gives the court the ability to make a decision on whether or not involuntary blood collection should be taken.
No, you are attempting, Madam Chair, to circumvent or change current law, because right now the court would not have a hearing ex parte without the person being present. And so what you are in fact trying to do is saying we believe that a person's liberty should be taken without them having an opportunity to be heard and to even tell this court if they've even received notice of this hearing. And we always, as attorneys, challenge a court's order, and we can always go back and challenge a court's order, especially if it was rendered with limited information. And so any individual should have an opportunity to provide all information if they did not receive that notice. So when I was talking to Senator Hoffman, we talked about, did the person receive notice? And if they did not receive notice, and now you have detained them, and you are keeping them in jail until they submit, then they can and should not be taken kept in jail forever. So within 24 hours, they should be able to go back in front of the court as they do under any other circumstances. And so from my perspective, it does not negate the possibility of being thoughtful when it comes to EMT workers and others, and even a Good Samaritan, even though there's no real clarity as to how that practically works. So, but again, if a person is going to be detained, they should have an opportunity to be heard.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to help me, because the conversation is, I don't understand the legal definition of notice. And that's where, when we were on the Senate floor, that's right. And that's, I did say, it'll help me understand a notice. So under the current statute definition of notice, what does notice involve? And that is just the publication, is that? Is it, help me, you lawyer types?
Mr. Debo, could you please clarify?
Yeah, I'm after. Yeah, I meant to pull up, I was just pulling up that statute.
And while you pull that up, Representative Johnson.
Yeah.
Senator Hoffman, as a deputy sheriff, I've served many, 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 many court papers. Some are personal, some are not. Looking at this, I have a feeling this would be personal service. I'm not positive on that, where we'd have to personally hand it to that person. If it is, and we go to that address and they're not there, we ask for that person. Whenever we serve a paper, we ask for the person whose name is on the paper. Some, especially those that are personal service, we have to hand it to them personally. Okay. We actually have to touch them with the papers, make sure that they have the papers in their hand. And what they do with them after that, that's their problem. I've had it where I gave them the paper and they've thrown them right back at me with not even looking at them. And they've been in violation of those papers, and the warrant's gone off to their arrest because they didn't actually read the paper. We do our, law enforcement does their best to get the papers to the person they're supposed to. When we knock on a door, is so-and-so here? No, they no longer live here. Do you know where they live? We try to find out where they live, and we try to get those papers to them. And some of them are time-sensitive, so we work very hard at that. At a certain point, if we're unable to find those people, then they're published in the paper, which whatever the paper is for that jurisdiction, the official paper, and they're published in that paper. And at that point, once they've been published, I believe they have to be published two different times. By statute, says what it has to be. And at that point, the court would be set up.
So if I, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
So if I understand, former sheriff, assistant with the deputy there, so when you're unable to find the individual, there's statute language that says how many times you've tried the notice, and there's documentation that shows that you've done the notice. And
yep.
My assumption then, and again, I'm not an attorney, I'm a sociologist, is to provide that to the court, and the court would determine whether or not whatever reasonable account, whatever the word is used on that piece, is that correct?
That is correct.
Interesting.
Just for clarity, Madam Chair, because I think that Representative Johnson has been thoughtful, but he's missing a couple pieces. One is, whenever something is published, it is usually published in Finance and Commerce, which is usually a paper that most people don't read. So it's not actually published in a paper that will say there's a high probability of the person being able to see it. So if there's going to be true notice for such a high bar of requiring the court's order to come forward or that allows the court to consider a matter ex parte, you want to make sure that the person received notice. And that notice should be personal service if you're going to now involuntarily or by force take someone's blood.
I think we have someone who wants to testify to this piece. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. Go ahead.
I saw you back and forth, so I thought it would be good.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Court Holkin, and counsel for the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. Been listening to the conversation. I think in order to get clarity on this, you have to look at the entire statute. And this particular one starts at 144.7401 and proceeds for several sections thereon. All of these things are taken care of, not in the one section that's being amended by this bill, but in the chapter as a whole. There is a provision, for one thing, the person in the non-consent proceeding has already refused. He's probably refused a number of times. That's a condition for using Section 2. You have to have a refusal. So there's to say that the person has no idea that this is going on, it is not accurate. Furthermore, the procedures, and again, that's in sections that precede this section, dealing with obtaining consent also require the informing of the source individual the various aspects of the statute. So, and this probably takes place numerous times, but even if it takes place only once, in order to get to Section 2 of 7407, you have to have a refusal. So the party has already refused. And you also have to have there are other preconditions, and one of those is the notice provision that you're talking about now, and jurisdiction. So in the petition, the petitioner would have to lay out to the court's content that jurisdiction exists, and that would be the residence of the source individual, or if he's in a medical facility, the location of the medical facility, and that 3 days notice has been served on the source individual, and the factual backup for that would have to be in the petition. Then the hearing takes place without the source individual. There are several conditions that have to be shown in that hearing, and there are provisions providing protection for the source individual even though he is not present. Those are listed in the law, but not in this bill, as privacy, health, safety, and economic interests. I'm not sure what economic interest refers to, but in terms of privacy and health, safety, they are also conditions of the procedures that take place, whether this is by consent or not by consent. And if the person doesn't show up, then you have this bill would allow for a hearing to take place, and the findings that the court has to make are listed out in the bill. All of those things have to be proven in the petition. None of them really involve the source individual. They involve mostly medical information and showing that there's a necessity and a time of essence in getting this material. If the source individual does not show up, and this is in the bill, then the judge can order the person to be, that the law enforcement can go out and find the person and bring them in. If the claim is that I never received notice, well, you have the facts of the notice in the petition and they've been heard by a judge, but if there's still such a claim, in this situation or any other situation that you can think of where a person has been taken into custody and the underlying requirements have not been met, that person can ask for, his lawyer can ask for an immediate hearing in front of a judge, because you have to have a legal basis for holding a person. That's called a writ of habeas corpus. And if that person wants to do that, you know, they can always do that, whether this law change, whether this bill passes as written or not. However, if the Senate amendment goes on the bill, you have negated the ex parte hearing, which is the purpose of the bill in the first place. And you're doing that based on I heard Senator Champion argue on the floor, and he's saying, well, if the person refuses, they ought to have a chance for a hearing. Well, that person already refused. That's why you're proceeding under Section 2 instead of Section 1 of existing law. And that's the hearing that took place. And being that time is of the essence, the bill allows an ex parte hearing. But all of the things in the hearing have to be heard. The judge has to go through down the list and find all of the findings.
Senator Champion.
To the testifier, what is the purpose of the ex parte hearing?
Mr. Holton.
The purpose of an ex parte hearing is to allow a hearing to take place under exigent circumstances, even when one stakeholder may not be present.
Oh, where in the law does it say exigent circumstances?
That that is the basis for this ex parte hearing. There can be many reasons for an ex parte hearing. One reason, we go in and get a TRO or an injunction without the other party, because they'll take extreme action if they're given notice. It's rare, but it happens. Or when a person refuses to attend, now you can get a default judgment, which is great if you're just looking for money, but if you need the cooperation of the source individual, a default judgment's not going to do you any good.
All right, I just a minute. Mm-hmm. Is it a question for this?
Yes.
Testifier? Okay, mm-hmm. Senator Champion.
To the testifier, you would agree that an ex parte order or a hearing allows for only one party to be heard. And we have situations where, even for domestic abuse issues, where there's a temporary order that's put in place, but the party has an opportunity to come in and be heard. Wouldn't you agree with that, or is that untrue?
Mr. Holton.
There are many such relationships in the various statutes in the volumes of law in Minnesota, and they serve different purposes. Mm-hmm. And in the one that you just mentioned, that may be appropriate. The legislature has decided in this situation, which is different than the situation that you outlined, time is of the essence, and we need to get this testing for bloodborne pathogens done.
To the testifier?
Senator Champion.
Isn't it true that the legislature did not determine that it was important that one should be able to have such a hearing without both parties being present, because that's the proposal that is before this body, is to change the law.
Senator Champion, that's correct. I can answer that question. But it was not considered previously, and that is the purpose of the bill today. Senator Champion.
So with that being said, there still is a basis under which a person should be heard. And if not, there should be a high standard as to why a person is not heard, such as if there was personal service on the individual. If there was personal service on the individual, wouldn't you agree that that would create a scenario where the person would no longer be in a position to say, I was not served, I didn't know anything about it? That's one question. And the second question is, isn't it true that you can request for a person to provide a blood sample, and that refusal in itself is not the same as a person coming before the court and articulating a rationale as to why they don't want to give a sample, and then allow the judge to determine whether it serves the public's interest in order to order a sample from a source individual? So if you can answer those two questions for me, that'd be great.
Senator Champion, I think you're asking for him to give you an opinion on, I just am trying to clarify these questions. One, whether or not he thinks that personal service should be in the bill, is that the question? And number two?
No, I didn't say that. I said, wouldn't you agree that personal service would negate any argument from any person saying they didn't know anything about the proceeding? And the second question was, he testified earlier the person has already refused the first time and given them an opportunity to come in and refuse again negates the bill. And I'm saying to him, don't you agree that if a person has an opportunity to come in and articulate to a judge as to why they believe or don't believe something should or should not be done, provides the judge then an opportunity to consider whether it's in the public's interest in order to make that order? To grant that order.
If you'd like to give testimony on that, Mr.
Pritchard. All I can say is that is in current law. They've had that opportunity, and they chose not to use it. And that's why this bill is before the legislature. And personal service is, of course, the highest form of service. But I've had cases where the person came in and said, well, that wasn't me. You know, so it's not a 100%. But the service requirement is in the law already.
Senator Abler.
Well, thank you. I appreciate this debate. I think it's a really important one. Senator Champion, one of your points, I was listening to your argument and I was almost persuaded. but and so your person, your icon person was this unwitting veteran who just didn't know. And hearing Mr. Holton and others talk, the person refused. And so they weren't unwitting. And maybe there is probably somewhere along the line some unwitting person. But if there's 100 individuals who are first responders, et cetera, who have been put at risk, potentially at risk, like Representative Johnson, and there's been years wondering, there's a half or a tenth of a person who's out there who's the unwitting person. Just that's the ratio I get, because most of the unwitting ones already said, no, I don't want to do it. And so we have to protect our first responders. But on the floor, I remember in the debate, some of the members of my caucus agreed with you because they thought this person was languished for 24 hours or longer in their jail cell. And I don't think that's possible. And so maybe you could comment about that. I think the people were sympathetic toward this unwitting veteran argument and that people are just going to rot in jail until they give a sample. But I don't think that's true either. And so I'm not persuaded by it.
And Senator Abler, law enforcement doesn't want to take this person to jail. They want to take them to the hospital to get the blood sample. So the goal isn't to, you know, hold them in custody until they comply. That's not the goal. The goal is to have the court determine whether or not a sample can be taken with or without their consent. That's the question. And should that hearing be allowed to go forward if the person doesn't show? So I think, unless there's somebody else that chooses to testify for or against the bill, I think we're ready to vote.
I feel prepared to vote.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against one of these provisions? All right. So the first motion that I'll make is I move that we adopt all the same and similar language, and then what will be left is the question on whether or not we adopt the different language. All right. So I would move that we adopt all the same and similar language as found in House File 2777. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion
for no.
All right. Now, the last question then before this conference committee is whether or not the Senate sentence on line 2.30 to line 2.32 should be adopted. Is there a motion on that? Senator Champion?
I move that we recess so that the Senate caucus can have an opportunity to talk.
As a member of the group here. My understanding. So you want to bring this in front of the caucus, which is meeting right now?
No.
Or just this caucus?
The conferee. We are the caucus.
Oh, you just want a caucus just for 2 minutes? That's fine.
I don't know if it's 2 minutes, but we should have an opportunity by us to talk.
Yep.
All right. We'll be in recess for 2 minutes.
Let's go in the hallway.
Back here.
Yeah. Let's go back here.
Yeah.
Did you ever know him?
Just like trying to persuade someone else to already change. So,
I understand that. Okay.
We'll reconvene, Senator Hoffman.
We're in session right now. A half hour after session closes, can we do that? What time does the House go into?
The House is going into session at 4 o'clock, Senator Hoffman, and we expect that we are going to be almost all evening, Senator Hoffman. We're doing body cameras. We're doing all sorts of other issues.
Can we be on the call?
Let's be on the call.
Is that okay? Can we be on the
call? How long are you going to be in session, Senator Hoffman?
I don't expect session to be long today.
So, Senator Hoffman, do you want to enlighten the committee as to what it is that you envision that... are you just going to be meeting? Are you going to be talking about a proposal? If we could get a sense of what it is that we're waiting for. Because at this point, you know, the House at this point is ready to vote.
I know that. So. Absolutely. The House is ready to vote. And I'm clear on a couple of things that Senator Champion's brought up. Is the part of the notification is personal service. And I know I'd asked counsel give me the definition of what is part of notice of service. And I know they were looking that up. So I think the way the Senate has it in front of them is if there's a way that you can strengthen the language of personal service, is that being part of the notification. And I don't live in that world, but if that can be, if we have that understanding, then I believe that we can strike 230 to 232 just as that is strengthened, because there is that need to make sure that that person was personally notified of the service.
And we could, and Mr. Chair?
Senator Champion.
Madam Chair, and then we'd like to just continue to talk to make sure that we're clear, but I believe that will allow us the time to talk and be clear so that we can move forward.
And if it's already part, Madam Chair, I'm sorry, if it's already part of the notification, then I think I would be satisfied. I just need to know that. And
Mr. Debo, I believe, has it up while okay. You were out in the hall. Mr. Debo.
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman. The court rule, this would be a civil procedure, this is as far as notice, and personal service is under 4.03 of the rules of civil procedure, and upon an individual, by delivering a copy to the individual personally, or by leaving a copy at the individual's usual place of abode with some person of suitable age and discretion then residing therein.
So like a rep. Pay
you
rep something
somebody. Well, it would be another adult resident of the home.
Okay.
And then if
back tomorrow.
No. Members, I'm not in control of the House schedule. We are in the last days of session. I think that this is significant. We've adopted the items that are the same and similar. We have one sentence, and the House is prepared to vote. If you plan to make another offer, we're gonna recess.
Madam Chair, I'm okay. That satisfies my need on personal, unless it's usually the same or incidental person. Because if somebody lived in a group home, you would have to have somebody who's in that kind of charge in it. To me, that covers that piece. So, I'm okay.
Madam Chair,
Senator Shannon,
I thought that we were going to meet, which we still should, and I believe that's the responsibility of us to talk as a caucus, and it's not just one person being okay. We all have to be okay. And so if the whole decision, we've talked about where we are, we should be able to come back after our fourth session.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
Senator Champion, I think what I'm hearing from the House side is they don't know when they're going to be coming back in session. Or back from session.
Correct.
We don't know how long our session is, and you know, I'm just one person on out of the three over here. But my satisfaction was understanding notice is what I had the concern on when you had brought your concern to me.
Personal service.
Personal service, and now
that's different. notice is different from personal service, and which personal is why we should be talking amongst each other and not just in front of the group and not allowing that pressure to be put on you to make a decision.
Right now, I don't feel any pressure. I feel pretty confident in accepting the House language.
Well, I think that we should talk first as a caucus, as we said that we were going to do before we came back in here. So my motion is for us to go in recess at the call of the chair, so that gives us a chance to talk amongst each other as we're supposed to as conferees. And then if at the end of that conversation people are comfortable, then that can be done at that particular time. But we are the Senate and they are the House.
The House has to agree with that.
If the House doesn't agree with that, then we stand to do, you have to agree with that.
I think that we should give a clear message from the House position on whether or not we're prepared to accept the Senate's language. So at this point, I think that the House, as the chair of this committee, I will move that the adoption of line 2.30 to 2.32 for the purposes of allowing the Senate to hear where the House is on those provisions. And I would speak against the adoption of those lines. I believe that lines 2.30 to 2.32 actually negate the bill. So I'm going to ask the committee to vote on those lines, and then you can make a decision as to how you would like to proceed from there. So all those in favor of adopting line 2.30 to 2.32 signify by saying aye. All opposed? No. Motion does not prevail. So, Senator Hoffman, at this point, the ball is in your court. I'm prepared to move forward. You, as the Senate, have to let us know what it is that you intend to do.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I get clarification from counsel? Counsel, you had said the word re-litigate the matter early on. Did I hear that right or wrong? Would you look at sections 2.30 to 2.32? And I know we got to go. Is that
Mr. Diebel?
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman. Yes, the way I interpret the Senate language is that you have an order issued by the court, and the person may or may not have been present, but doesn't comply with that order. And at that point, the police are allowed to involuntarily take the sample. But under the Senate language, that person would be then allowed to come before the court, and the court is told to determine whether to order the person to submit a sample. And my interpretation of what's taken place up to that point is that the court has already ordered that person to provide a sample, and at this point they are saying, no, I'm not going to comply with that order. So in common legal parlance, they would be in contempt of the order of not complying with the order, and it may have been issued ex parte or not, because this is not just the person who wasn't at the hearing. It could have been a person that was at the hearing and walked away and then still didn't comply with the court order. So the two issues are related, but not necessarily connected in all cases, as opposed to ex parte.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you did validate my understanding was what you had said. It, to me, it seems like a redundant piece. And so,
well, hold it.
Lynn, finish, Senator Champion. I'll call on you next. Senator Hoffman, go ahead.
And I'm just talking about, this is for my satisfaction of understanding the process, and you've said it to me the best that you can, and I did understand what you had said early on, so thank you for clarifying that and validating that for me.
Senator Champion.
Just for clarity, even for our co-chair, what he's talking about when he says relitigation is because there's no distinction between a person who showed up at the hearing, whether they came to the hearing and had an opportunity to be heard, and now if they refuse, now they get a second bite at the apple. That's one process. Then that would be true because you're relitigating it because they had an opportunity to be heard. For a person who does not show up at the hearing and there was an ex parte order, that hearing occurred without the person being there, so they never got a chance to be heard. And if they were not personally served, there's nothing to suggest that they in fact receive notice in order to be there or even to know about the hearing.
Well, so Senator Champion,
I want to make sure that there is that distinction, and with the essence of time, which is why it would be important for us to talk so that we can even confer with Mr. Backus and some others in order to make sure that we have a good understanding as to what we are saying, because as a non-lawyer, which you're very articulate and smart, there are these nuances that sometimes when there's a notion that's put out there that's embraced in a way that says, oh, we are relitigating this. You're not relitigating it if it's a person who did not have an opportunity to be there because they did not receive notice, and therefore there was an ex parte order that was issued by the court.
Well,
and so I just want to make sure that we are clear about that from my vantage point. And we do have a judge in the audience, too, that we can talk to later.
Senator Champion, I just want to make it really clear on the record that we require this kind of services for all kinds of civil hearings. And when people don't show up in court, there are many times when we issue default orders. And in cases where you're actually doing a search warrant for someone's blood, the court hears that search warrant and the judge signs off or doesn't sign off, in many instances, of course, without anyone present, except the person requesting the search warrant. So there are many places in law that that's the case. So there's really one line difference between the House and the Senate language. And the House has clearly indicated to the Senate that we're not prepared to take the Senate's language. Okay. So the Senate at this point has to make the decision on whether or not you're prepared to vote and determine what we want to do on this conference committee report. And at this point, I'm going to defer to Senator Hoffman because Senator Hoffman is the lead on this committee. And so if Senator Hoffman is prepared to vote to adopt the conference committee report, given we have adopted the same and similar language, we will move forward and vote. And if Senator Hoffman is requesting something else, he's got to tell us what it is he's requesting.
I'm sorry, Senator Champion. I'm satisfied as an individual. I'm satisfied with what I've gotten from counsel and what I've heard. So I'm prepared as the co-chair of this committee to go ahead and process this now, and you know, me personally. So
I think that goes against Senate rules, and so I just want you to be very clear about that.
Senator Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just about the Senate rules, I think it's our job to come and defend the Senate position as best we can and listen and learn and find the best way to bring the ideas that the Senate brought forward. And at some point, you have to yield. And at some point, I think the concerns you expressed on the floor are 99%, 97% satisfied with what I've heard in the testimony and why people in my caucus would have voted on behalf of your amendment. I think if they sat through this, they would be comfortable that the protections they were seeking, which is why I'm comfortable as well. Just to, not trying to sell out the Senate or be unfair to your position, but I think that you're 97% there. I don't think you're going to get to 100. But I think if we don't pass this bill, some of the people who are protecting us aren't going to go and protect us. The blood, I'm not going there. And something bad will happen, and I'm not willing to have that happen.
So the only thing that I request of my chair is that we have an opportunity to talk to our general counsel and confer, and that can happen within the next hour, and then we can go from there. And I'm making that request at the conferee and a member of the Senate.
I concur with Senator Abler on this, Senator Champion. We've talked to counsel. We brought the language that you saw was fit. I now feel that the process is good in and of itself, and as well as what Senator Abler is saying. So I don't think there's any more need for, as far as my satisfaction goes, to seek more counsel, because I'm satisfied with the counsel here that has given me. And so,
did you notify our Senate counsel that we were meeting this morning?
He was here.
Where is he? Mr.
Backus
is here.
Hi, Mr. Coffer.
Yep.
All right.
At this time, then, the House, as chair, would move House File 2777 Conference Committee with the adoption of the same and similar language. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. With that, this meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.